Welcome to Sentient Developments Radio, transhumanist and techno-progressive perspectives on science, philosophy, ethics, and the future of intelligent life. My name is George Dvorsky, and you are listening to the audiocast of my blog, Sentient Developments. Topics discussed on this program include human enhancement, bioethics and emerging technologies, cosmology, metaphysics, spirituality, gender issues, animal welfare, and much, much more. So sit back, relax, and open your mind to Sentient Developments Radio. Hello and welcome once again to Sentient Developments Radio. My name is George Dvorsky. I'll be your host for this podcast. And I've got a special episode today. It is a recording of my presentation that I gave last year in Chicago at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technology Symposium. And it was on Monday, July the 23rd, and we did it in Chicago at the Fairmont Hotel and the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, or the IEET. We put together a symposium called Securing the Longevity Dividend, Building the Campaign for Anti-Aging Science. And what we tried to do there is show exactly that we can start to frame the discussion of anti-aging as being a dividend, as something that's good, something that is beneficial, not just from a moral perspective, but from a sociological and even economic perspectives, that it's good to make people healthy. It's good to have healthier, longer-lived people. Dying and death and that whole industry based around death is bad. So who did we bring in to do that? Well, we had a keynote speaker by the name of Stuart J. Olshansky, as I'm sure many of you are familiar with. And he talked about specifically securing the longevity dividend. We also had David Meltzer present, and he talked about taxes on the longevity dividend and wondering, is there a price to ignoring them? We had Aubrey de Grey there, and he argued for the scientific feasibility of anti-aging. Dr. James Hughes presented. He talked about building coalitions for anti-aging in medicine. And Ronald Bailey of Reason Magazine was there. He spoke of the political economy of the longevity dividend. We also had Anders Sandberg there, and he talked about policy scenarios for the longevity dividend. And then there was little old me. I talked about popular arguments for and against longevity. All of these presentations, by the way, are available at the IEET website in both transcription form and as MP3s. And courtesy of the IEET, I will be now presenting to you my talk. It's just a little over half an hour. And again, I'm talking about the arguments both for and against longevity, and in particular, the most popular arguments both for and against longevity. So we're going to get to that, and that's going to consist of the entire show today. Before I get started, though, just want to pat myself on the back a little bit here. When I downloaded the MP3 from the IEET site and I imported it into my audio player here, which I use Audacity, by the way, which is an open source program, and it's pretty darn good for something that's free, it played it back not just a little quicker than usual, but hideously faster. Like it compressed, I'm not sure how this worked or why the MP3 was done this way. If you guys know the answer to that, please let me know. But the MP3 itself was compressed down to just a little over 6 minutes. So you can imagine what it sounded like. So basically it took 36-minute talk and compressed it into 6 minutes. So I thought, oh my God, I can't use this. I can't use this in the podcast. But not one to give up, I thought I'd give it a bit of a try and seeing if I could tweak it a little bit. So in Audacity, you can change. There's a function in there, a command. Let's see. I'll pull it up here right now. Change the speed, I believe it is, or change tempo, one of the two. Or even might be change pitch. Doesn't matter. But what I did is I did the calculation. So it took a 6 minute, 42 second clip, which should have been 36 minutes and 19 seconds, which represents a difference of 81.55%. In other words, it was 81.55% faster than it should have been. And I thought, this is, I'm going to compress it, or rather I'm going to time expand it. So I expanded it both in terms of time and in pitch. And I thought, in a million years, this is not going to work, that it's still going to be off at least a little bit, or there's going to be some kind of strange artifact, so that it's going to make me sound a little bit too fast, a little bit too slow. Like, you know, you can't be absolutely perfect. So I keyed in the percentage, minus 81.55, crossed my fingers, and wouldn't you know it, it came out absolutely perfect. I don't think I'm off even by a little bit. Maybe my voice is just a slight, like just a slight bit too low, because I rounded up. But better to round up in that case than round down, so your voice doesn't sound too high. And it sounded absolutely perfect. Of course, it's gone through a rather meticulous audio process, so there's going to be some loss, but it's still very usable, I think, and not any less usable than it was before in the format that it came in. So there you go. I'm not just a pretty face. I can actually do a little bit of audio editing. And, well, actually, I should laugh. I actually have an education in digital audio editing, so I should be able to do the sort of stuff. I spent 3 years at a community college learning how to record, produce, and edit digital music, and even worked for a year in a recording studio. Now, that was in a former life, I'll tell you what, back in the mid-1990s or so. But all the things we do. So anyways, there you go. Enough of my audio techno geekdom. And without further ado, and we're just going to play a quick track here from Justice, and we'll get on to my presentation from the Longevity Symposium. And again, it was presented back in July of 2007. Speaking today about the most popular arguments both for and against longevity. This is not going to be a discussion of the scientific arguments that are put forth. I'll leave that to the biogerontologists and the specialists. This is going to be more of the popular arguments as you would hear. I mean, these are the kinds of arguments that do come out of academia and some of the political lobbies, but it's also the kind of argument that you get from the person on the street that you bump into, that if you mention this in casual conversation, you can almost assuredly expect these kinds of retorts and objections to these sorts of issues of life extension. So in a way, this is kind of to arm ourselves and to think about the various ideas that are out there. And when I first prepared this, I massively went through all the literature I could find and synthesized it and wrote it out, and it was hideously long. It would have been well over an hour. So the challenge for me was to compress it, both in terms of which arguments to put forth, but also to find some common ground and to categorize and see are these arguments, much to what Anders was speaking about earlier, can we kind of find certain consistencies with where these arguments are coming from? And hopefully that's what I've done, and we can go about discussing it. And again, this is not necessarily the best arguments. By no means are these the most valid or credible or concerning arguments. It's simply a discussion of what's out there in terms of the discussions that are happening today. Also, I'm not going to be analyzing the arguments for their worth. I'm not going to be discussing, to a larger or lesser degree, I will add some anecdotes here or there, but we can always discuss afterwards where you might think that these particular arguments were either valid or invalid. Okay. I'm going to start off with the opposition to radical life extension.
And I discovered that there tends to be three different types of threads, or three different types of ways in which the opponents will draw their arguments from. There tend to be the moral and the ethical arguments. There are the practical arguments, which are the real hard and fast inhibitors to life extension, where they may not actually have an ethical problem with it, but they say, look, we can't do it because there's an actual realistic reason why we can't do this. And then, again, one thing I found as I was parsing through all the material was I kept finding what I considered to be faulty arguments or arguments that had fallacies built in. And because I found so many of them, I thought I should probably include them. And we'll save that kind of at the end of the discussion of the opponents. Basically, here's what I came up with. There were five broad categories with which you can, I would hope, pigeonhole any argument that you find in opposition to radical life extension. There's the appeal to nature, that there are undesirable psychological consequences to radical life extension, that there are undesirable social consequences, that the reasons for life extension have to deal with questionable motivations and skewed priorities. And as I said, we're also going to talk about some common argumentative fallacies that are used in opposition. You'll have to forgive me if I do refer to my notes from time to time. One of the most common arguments that is put forth in opposition to life extension is the appeal to nature. I'm sure we're all familiar with this. The suggestion that what is natural is inherently good or right, and that what is unnatural is somehow bad or wrong. And that a number of critics make the claim that life extension, of course, is a violation of the natural order, that humanity is tampering with nature, which is inherently good. It's often argued that the quest for life extension goes against the natural cycles of birth and death, and that if we attained immortality, that we will have stepped so far outside of the natural order that we could no longer be considered as humans. And advocates of this view tend to argue that what is natural is better, that life extension is an unnatural and dehumanizing usurpation of the natural order. Some of the most common proponents of this view include Leon Cass, Francis Fukuyama, Bill McKibben, and Daniel Callahan. Many of these individuals have already been named today. Death is not just, a violation of the natural order, but it's seen as something that is good and very much in our collective and personal best interest, which would run in direct contradiction to what the life extensionists would argue. Where am I here? McKibben, for example, argues that without death, life would be robbed of its meaning. And humans, would not have the opportunity to sacrifice for their children. There'd be no reason to pour out a life's worth of work under the literal deadline of mortality. And this adjunct in the appeal to nature essentially states that the meaning of life is somehow something that you pull out of our mortality, that a limited lifespan is what motivates people to spend the time that they have wisely, and it's through a sense of urgency, they argue, that we're able to refine and exploit our best qualities. Even things like courage, heroism, sacrifice, creativity, these arise from the acknowledgement that I and everyone else only has so much time here. Consequently, the implication is that life extension would create a population that's lazy, spoiled, apathetic, self-centered, and indulgent, and that life wouldn't be serious or meaningful without death. Death, apparently, also provides us with morality and a need for morality. That if we couldn't sacrifice ourselves for something, we would not sacrifice ourselves if we were immortal. And in this sense, attributes such as virtue and morality have a direct relationship with us, ourselves, in our condition as vulnerable, transient entities, and in how we suffer and sacrifice. Death, therefore, it's got a social function in this regard. That self-sacrifice, dying in combat or policing, so-called honorable deaths are actually quite important to, I would say, the natural order or the proper and normal social functioning of society. Sorry. Another argument, and this was, I think, touched upon earlier, is that it would cause people to become extremely conservative and risk-averse. I mean, who wants to risk their lives, their indefinite lives, I shouldn't use the word immortality so much, that who would risk their indefinite lifespan for it to go hang gliding or to go parachute jumping and so forth, if you're considering what's at stake here. I guess the argument here is that if you know you're only going to live to be about 80 or 100 years old, it's not so much that I'm putting at risk, but if it's 1,000 years, 10,000 years, then suddenly the stakes are much higher. So the fear is that you'd have a really conservative, risk-averse population that wouldn't have any fun. It's also been argued, and this primarily by such thinkers as Leon Cass, is that not only would life be devoid of meaning, but it could potentially be that beauty could actually be pulled from our lives, that beauty is actually derived from an object's and the subject's sense of impermanence in the world. If I could quote Cass, just as a pretty flower is beautiful because we know it'll eventually wilt, and a sunset is beautiful because it is short-lived. The anti-life extension camp, they're also very sensitive to, I guess, what they might call utopian ideals. They often champion the imperfections of humanity, stating that it is that which makes life worth living and that they fear stagnant and static existences, instead lauding the benefits that are wrought by imperfections, stress, and challenge. Bill McKibben, the author of Enough: Staying Human in an Engineered Age, he said, I like this body, with all its limitations, up to and including the fact that it's going to die. A key element of the call to nature argument is, in fact, its human-centeredness. Life extension interventions are condemned in the same way that transhumanistic technologies are condemned, whether they be genetic modifications or cybernetic enhancements and those sorts of things, that these are interventions that will somehow dehumanize us or lessen what we currently are. And again, quoting from Cass, the pursuit of perfect bodies and further life extension will deflect us from realizing more fully the aspirations to which our lives naturally point, from living well rather than merely staying alive. And as I thought I'd mention this as well, I don't know if I have a slide for this one. Yeah, as a subset to this argument as well, I guess to the call to nature, perhaps this is the call to the unnatural, and you will get this from time to time, I'm sure many of you have, are maybe non-secular variations of the naturalistic appeal. And that is that there are broader metaphysical implications to death, that the materialist assumption is in fact wrong, and that something does in fact await us on the other side, whether it be heaven, some kind of transcendental rebirth, or what have you. So that's, I have heard that from time to time. Okay, so that's the first category. The second, as I said, undesirable psychological conssequences, that dealing with the inadequacy of the human psyche to deal with radical longevity. And it's a distinctive argument, but there's considerable crossover between this line of thinking and the line of argumentation that was just put forward, that humans would be bored, apathetic, selfish, and so on. These are really assertions that human psychology is not set up to deal with this. It is distinctive, however, in that, from the naturalist argument, in that this is named as a practical barrier to life extension rather than the more abstract call for the preservation of the natural and the moral delineation between good and bad. This is the big one. We're going to be bored when we have indefinite lifespans. And that we would be bored and life would be full of repetitious tedium. So severe would this boredom be, actually, that we should probably forego life extension altogether. And it's an unpredictable social experiment. We don't know what's going to await us beyond our expected 120 years right now. It's dangerous and reckless for us to go down that path. As John Cougar Mellencamp once said, life goes on long after the thrill of living is gone. Indeed, the charge that older people will have lacked the passion of youth is a commonly cited argument against life extension. But as Mark Walker noted, who will be joining us a bit later, he had a paper called Boredom, Experimental Ethics, and Superlongevity. Admittedly, boredom seems like a rather trivial objection to radical life extension, that really what's being discussed is something a bit more profound and a bit more deep-rooted, and that is the condition of ennui. That the condition of ennui is a state of chronic and debilitating, again, debilitating is crucial here, that it will actually affect the proper functioning of an individual. They will have debilitating existential apathy and disdain. Ennui is derived from the Greek term to be annoyed. is defined as a reactive state to wearingly dull, repetitive, or tedious stimuli. Suffering from a lack of interesting things to see, hear, or do, either physically or intellectually, it's a condition of pervasive boredom, in the sense that one tires of the earth itself. And the only solution, as some philosophers have posited, such as Bernard Williams, is death. There's also the possibility of madness. We'll go insane from having such long lives. Take, for example, the Twilight Zone episode, A Nice Place to Visit, in which a gambler believes himself to be in heaven. He's in a casino, and he's winning all the tables. He cannot possibly lose, and he's loving this at first, but as time goes by, it's starting to get a bit predictable, obviously. It gets boring, and it gets tedious. He assumes that he's in heaven at this point. It gets so bad for him that he actually, at this point, wishes to be sent to the other place, at which point we have our classic Twilight Zone ending narration, a scared, angry little man who never got a break. Now he has everything he's ever wanted, and he's going to have to live with it for an eternity in the Twilight Zone. This is an interesting one, that we will lose a sense of psychological self-continuity over time. And I know that I can certainly relate to this as someone that's 30-something, that I do remember what it was like to be in my early 20s and even as a teenager, but I'm so far removed from that person as to be de facto a different person altogether. The suggestion is that given hundreds of years, or potential, if not thousands of years, that you'll be so detached from your previous self. In fact, you'll be so detached from that person who actually bought into life extension that you didn't actually make the decision to have such a long life. Again, this is the argument. I'm not saying it's a great argument, but this is the argument. That actually defeats, in a sense, the purpose of life extension, because the person who wanted life extension no longer exists, because you've changed so much. Okay, undesirable social consequences. And again, in principle, one could be in favor of life extension in theory or on moral grounds, but be opposed to it due to the practical implications of its onset. And again, not only might there be psychological consequences to life extension, but there may be severe and intractable social consequences. What is feared will be the so-called tragedy of the commons. And again, this is in many respects the obverse of what we are here for today at the Longevity Dividend, saying that, you know what, there are actually positive social consequences, not negative social consequences, which I'll touch upon very briefly later. There are, of course, the issues of social and distributive injustices. Life-extending interventions, it's argued, are bound to be both cost-prohibitive for a large segment of human population, and because there's going to be distribution issues, that with something that we should probably seriously question. So again, issues of cost, issues of access. And I guess the assumption here is that the widening gap between the rich and poor will lead to greater social inequality, and I guess, again, an overall social regression in quality of life. I have to move here. That's, again, so many arguments that I'm worried about going over time. Another potential problem are undesirable demographic skews, and that these will be skews that are not going to be positive things. If only the rich have access, for example, both racial and class balances might be upset, and we'll end up with a divided world of parallel populations and new classes altogether, and perhaps individuals of or groups of society that can't even really relate to each other on many levels. Francis Fukuyama has warned that we risk creating a nursing home world filled with aging, miserable, debilitated people draining resources from the young to keep themselves alive. Or, more realistically to what we're addressing, in a world where elderly people would forever remain... In a world where elderly people would remain forever physically and psychologically vibrant, workplace demographics and the issue of retirement would become quite pertinent. How will younger generations work their way into positions of more authority if the older generation never has to give up those roles? And this is what a legal philosopher, Stephen Horbin, has called the problem of incumbency. That in a world of life extension, people of authority or wealth or power, they would remain there indefinitely. And there could be the problem of generational dominance, misguided and dangerous people wouldn't wither away and die, and elites would not give up their positions, whether in business or in politics. There's also the threat of scientific and cultural stagnation. It's a well-known cycle of life that has been argued, and it may provide other benefits to society, and that the elimination of death may curtail important social processes that we take for granted. There's the possibility that we'll have fewer fresh ideas. Quantum physicist Max Planck, he once said, A new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die and a new generation grows up that is familiar with it. Similarly, in the context of social change, I think, for example, the issue of same-sex marriages, where that's an issue, cultural issue, that's been almost exclusively divided along demographic lines, where you have an older generation that are very uneasy about it and a younger generation for which it's an absolute no-brainer. So that this kind of thing could result in cultural and social stagnation. This is also a big one, and issues of overpopulation, environmental non-sustainability, and other Malthusian scenarios. These are extremely common arguments levied against the possibility of radical life extension. Environmentalist E.O. Wilson, he's calculated that for every person in the world to reach present U.S. levels of consumption with existing technology, you would need four planet Earths. Suffice to say, life extension would greatly compound the issue. And this is very much a neo-Malthusian argument, the argument being that the Earth, in terms of its food, water, energy, everything that makes up our global footprint, cannot possibly keep up with the perpetually increasing population. Okay, questionable motivations and skewed priorities. Opponents of life extension, they frequently question the motivations of those in search of extended lives and suggest that there are much more pressing concerns for people to be, for human civilization. Now, a number of critics like Callahan believe that our motivations for wanting extended lives is deeply problematic and that there's no known social good coming from the conquest of death. The quest for life extension has been referred to as antisocial, and those who wish to live longer lives have been accused of being selfish, arrogant, hubristic, irreverent, childish, and narcissistic. And those are the nice things that they have to say about life extensions. Critics are also aware of the potential for life extension to hit the mainstream and to touch upon maybe more perversive or more pervasive or widespread desire for longer life. Consequently, some critics have already made the proclamation that governments should be required to intervene and do what's right for society, because people will not do what's in their best interest or what's in society's collective best interest, and the state will be required to uphold the social good. Brian Alexander, who authored the book Rapture, How Biotechnology Became the New Religion, he once asked Francis Fukuyama if the government has the right to tell its citizens that they have to die, and Fukuyama answered, yes, absolutely. And Leon Kass has noted, the finitude of human life is a blessing for every individual, whether he knows it or not. John Harris, author of Immortal Ethics, has referred to this threat, I suppose, as generational cleansing, that at some point, because the technologies actually exist, that in a real sense, in a de facto sense, this would be a form of a kind of genocide, a kind of generational cleansing that would be enforced upon the elderly population, whatever we would decide could possibly potentially be an elderly population. It could be, by today's standards, 80, 100, 120, or maybe a more radical standard, 500 might be enough, 750. But the idea is that there will be some cleansing will have to be enacted in order to suit some kind of social, what's in the best social interest. One more quote from Cass, why not? Simply to covet a prolonged lifespan for ourselves is both a sign and a cause of our failure to open ourselves to procreation and to any higher purpose. The desire to prolong youthfulness is not only a childish desire to eat one's life and keep it, it is also an expression of a childish and narcissistic wish incompatible with devotion to posterity. So again, there's something wrong with life extensionists in their quest for long life. There are more important things for us to deal with right now. That's global warming, we've got human poverty to deal with, disease, all these other issues that most absolutely deserve greater consideration than anti-aging, life-extending technologies. Okay, this is one of my favorite areas. I love to take apart arguments. Now, arguably, life extension has at times been the victim of pseudo-skepticism, which is characterized by unfair, biased, presupposed, and overzealous lines of attack. Everyone is familiar with ad hominem attacks. against and ad hominem attacks against life extensionists are particularly common. They'll be labeled as, well, I'll get to that actually. Yes. That they're characterized as being proponents, promoters, pseudoscientists, or practitioners of pathological science. And again, I think this kind of speaks to the high degree of emotionalism that's invested into this particular issue. The mere suggestion is that there's something deeply wrong with life extensionists, and by consequence, there must be something deeply wrong with life extension itself. And as what Dr. Jay was referring to earlier, about a couple of years ago, Technology Review's editor-in-chief, Jason Ponton, he really laid into, where's Aubrey? He laid into Aubrey, I'm sure Aubrey knows about this one. And Ponton used the opportunity not so much to critique Aubrey's strategies, as he did use it as an opportunity to launch some personal attacks against them, referring to Aubrey, if you'll forgive me, as a troll, some name-calling, and he slammed Aubrey as a person, questioned his life choices, and criticized his personal habits and appearance. And we're not talking the man on the street, we're talking about the editor of Technology Review magazine. And it doesn't have to be an emotional attack like this or a character attack like this. It can also be an accusation of psychological instability or quirkiness, eccentricity. Psychology Today recently put out an article about life extensionist Michael Anisimov, who's here with us today, and it was called Champions of the Lost Cause. And the presence of the piece in a psychology magazine, even if it might be a popular magazine, hinted that Anisimov's quest for life extension was somehow psychologically quirky or eccentric, that this is not something a normal person would want to pursue for themselves. All right, enough of the... So that's the arguments. How am I doing for time, Jay? I have 5 minutes. I kind of thought this might happen. Okay. Well, we'll do what we can in the 5 minutes we have left. There you go. Okay. For those of us who are in promotion of life extension, we also will put forth ethical, moral reasons for doing so, and we will also bring forward practical arguments, although it's very top-heavy in the first category. To date, the arguments have almost been exclusively arguments as to why life is valuable, why we need to extend life, and not really having either the evidence or the wherewithal to start to develop some real hard and fast reasons from a social perspective or from an economic perspective as to why we should do this, which is why an event like this is so unbelievably encouraging, because one can make the case now that that's starting to happen and we're starting to mature, that we are now actually putting forth a real excellent case for, again, social and economic benefits for radical life extension. As well, I find that arguments on behalf of life extension tend to be somewhat on the defensive. I mean, let's face it, we are under attack, and our arguments are very much meant to deflect many of the arguments that have already put forward. So they are, I guess, in a way, they deserve kind of mention unto themselves. There are four broad categories that the prolongivists will pull their arguments into one of these slots. The value of life and the undesirability of death. The ethical and legal right to life extension, that there are desirable social consequences, and that really it's an issue more of managing the inevitable and working towards the feasible. Life is good, death is bad. That pretty much says it all for a life extensionist. If I can quote... Yeah, let's leave it at that and just keep moving on. But that being said, you just can't say life is good. It's almost a self-evidentiary argument. We have to actually explain why that is the case. So it's actually that. Where do I have this? Unfortunately, it's gone now. But we do have to at least justify why it is actually the act of living that we value, and not just life itself. This has already been discussed as well. The devaluation of life, that a death at the age of 17 is far more tragic than a death at the age of 87, and the life extensionists would respond by saying that that's based on our conditioned response and our expectations of a maximum lifespan, that if we could live to 1,000, therefore would we consider the death of someone at the age of 350 just as tragic? Is this an issue of relativity? Is this an arbitrary evaluation of life? Could we ever come up with a maximum lifespan that's not arbitrary. I argue that absolutely not. And I'm just cooking along now. I'm sorry, I'm not going to elaborate too much on all these. These issues, they do have rather deep, I guess, existential connotations. And there's a panoply of related issues, including the meaning of a good life, the infinite totality that is death, the right to one's own life, issues of dignity as they pertain to aging, death, and dying, and the bizarre acknowledgement that we exist in the first place. It was said by Greek philosopher Epicurus that death is nothing to us when we're dead, that it's a non-condition. But that said, death is most certainly to the frustration of the living. People who desire to go on living, they have objectives for the future, objectives which is hoped will translate to real experiences. And death can be seen as the denier of these desires, which is why death is seen as something that is so undesirable. Great quote from J.R.R. Tolkien. "There is no such thing as a natural death. Nothing that happens to man is ever natural, since his presence calls the whole world into question. All men must die, but for every man his death is an accident, and even if he knows it and consents to it, an unjustifiable violation." I love how that's almost an absolute obverse to Leon Cass's question or issue about how whether the death is to the valuable whether we know it or not. That Tolkien would argue that it's actually unjustifiable whether we acknowledge it or not. Again, that death tends to be seen as something overwhelmingly undesirable and wasteful. Accumulated memories, experiences, and the wisdom of others has been lost forever upon death. Moreover, it's a terrible thing for us to have to deal with death. Quoting Eliezer Yudkowsky, who experienced the death of a sibling a few years ago, death and experiencing it when someone you're close to dies is nothing any sentient being should ever have to deal with. And as well, life extensionists, they are very much cognizant of the fact that hundreds of thousands of people die each day. They have a death counter in mind that this is an absolute catastrophe that is happening now, something that should most definitely be eliminated. And this is how they do frame it, that it is this kind of this global catastrophe that is death. Okay, I'm going to skim ethical and legal issues. One could make a case that the pro-life ethics is sound, and therefore it does extend into it being a civil rights issue. So, for example, I'm going to skip that. Sorry. I do want to touch upon it as being a civil issue of civil liberties. Right here. Yeah. That it is among our rights as individuals to manipulate and transform our bodies as we see fit. That sane, responsible, and consenting adults deserve the benefit of the doubt to apply such technologies to themselves, and it's an issue of personal freedom and choice. And again, because so many of the opponents to life extension have argued that we should eliminate it altogether because not everyone can immediately have access to it, the pro-longevists would say that this does not make it therefore unjust to develop life extension anyways to those who can initially afford it. John Davis has said that in other contexts we accept the general principle that taking from the haves is only justified if in doing so make the have-nots more than marginally better off. If life extension is possible, one must weigh the life years at stake for those who receive the treatment against whatever burdens making such treatments available might impose on the have-nots who cannot afford the treatments. And one thing that the IEET is very cognizant of is working to ensure that these types of technologies are have as broad access as possible. And also the issue of these costs decreasing over time. I don't think there's any technology that's ever existed that hasn't actually had a cost that kind of bottoms out at some point. Okay, desirable social consequences. The potential for long life, say the pro-longevists, will have positive social consequences. It's been said that one consequence of a protracted life is increased personal responsibility and accountability. Individuals will have a longer time to deal with the repercussions of their negative actions, and that long-lived people will have developed a deep and profound wisdom, particularly as it pertains to social relationships. Nick Bostrom has argued that with longer life expectancy, people will have a personal stake in the future, and this will lead to more responsibility and sustainable policies. It also makes utilitarians happy. Michael Anisimov has said that life extension is important to utilitarians because billions of people want it. Utilitarianism is about doing what makes people happy, so life extension is automatically a utilitarian priority. The longevity dividend, we know what that's all about. Now, another interesting take, one that I'm somewhat partial to, is that we're actually talking about curtailing the inevitability, and what is inevitable, or what James would say, that arguing against the plow type argument. That what we really should be doing is not talking about eliminating life extension and the possibility for life extension, but let's talk about how are we going to manage the process and deal with something that is also feasible and get in the whole issue of obligations. Life extension is in effect. And again, this is one argument that is made on behalf of life extension, that it's something that's been in place for quite some time, arguably for 3,000 years or so. And of course, we all know what life expectancy and different, I guess, health habits have done over the last 100 years. Biologist Stephen Ostad has said that it is, in fact, the logical continuation of the medical sciences. And he's even suggested that proponents of life extensionists frame their arguments in such a way as to appeal to those values that are already in place. That to this end, we should be arguing and advocating for the conquest of disease, reduce suffering and infirmity, to give seniors a higher quality of physical lives, rather than promoting an end to aging and the conquest of death, which for many people is a rather unsettling topic that makes them uneasy. Transhumanists and humanists in general would again argue that this is the continuation of the human mission in general, that combined with the legal aspect, ethical aspect, that the issue is that we do in fact have to bring this within our purview of responsibilities as a compassionate people and make this happen. Injunctions against the development of life extension would most assuredly open up a Pandora's box of problems. Preventing the development and proliferation of life-extending technologies would be extremely difficult and dangerous. Demand would be through the roof, with desperate people willing to do virtually anything they get their hands on these things, and it could cause a number of problems, including black markets, the impossibility of ever setting up a consistent trans-global regulation, unregulated labs and testing, biotourism, there would be limited access to those who are unscrupulous and maybe even rich, and the possibility of dangerous and risky end-user experimentation. This goes true almost for any kind of biotechnology. That's the problem of prohibition. That's what I'm getting at. Now, interestingly as well, actually I'm remarkably close to the end, is the issue of feasibility and obligations. And one thing I'm always very interested in what ways are we obligated, and that if we can actually show that the practical inhibitors to, or the seemingly practical inhibitors to life extension are surmountable, and these are not intractable problems. In what ways now are we actually obligated to do these things? And Aubrey de Grey has argued that we are responsible to future generations. And Reason Science correspondent Ronald Bailey has noted our ancestors, that is our grandparents and parents, did not ask our permission to do so. They just went ahead and did it. It's unlikely our descendants will have any more reason to regret our decision than we have to regret our forebears. And a number of technologists, they contend that many of opponents of life extension, they ignore the technological and sociological advancements that are happening, that we may drastically reduce the global footprint, resolve environmental problems, harness safe, alternative, and high-energy sources, learn to manage the potential physiological and psychological artifacts of life extension, even alternative living arrangements and radical living arrangements that could house millions of people and so on, where the elbow room issue becomes a non-issue. And I'll end at least this section with a quote from Ray Kurzweil. We need to expand our intelligence and our capacity for experience, which is exactly what new technologies will enable us to do. Then an extended lifespan would become not only tolerable, but a remarkable frontier where we could pursue the real purpose of life, which is the creation and appreciation of knowledge. And I'll end it right there. Okay. Thank you.